Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Srikant Vasan. Srikant is the founder and managing partner with Avesta Fund. Srikant, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Christian. Glad to be here.
My pleasure. So let's start with Avesta Fund. What's the investment thesis?
So we basically invest in founders that are finding a way to make a difference in the problems of climate change and our economic opportunity. So we tend to focus on early stage, tends to be around seed stage, all across North America, in a range of climate and economic opportunity related themes. And so one of the things we try to do, having grown up in the tech world, both as an operator and an investor in the tech world, we've seen a bunch of lessons learned in that world, which we think can be brought to the benefit of the climate tech world. And so that's one of the things we're trying to do, is bringing some proven models from there. For instance, just before this, I was a partner on Techstars investment team and had a chance to look at hundreds of companies that go through the Techstars system, because we sat across all the 45 odd programs that Techstars ran at that time. And I've seen some useful lessons there over the years to try to bring to the world of climate, which is something that we're focused on. We've been around for just about 4 years now, so we're pretty young as a fund, but we've been pretty active. We've made 44 investments to date, and so continue to deploy and keeping our heads down and trying to do a good job.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And so what were some of those key lessons you took away from Techstars that you apply today at Avesta?
Yeah, and I would say both across Techstars, but also I've been a founder, CEO of a few venture-backed startups. Done that. I was also entrepreneur in residence at Mobius Ventures, which is SoftBank's venture arm, and Battery Ventures. After I'd sold my first company and before I'd started the second, so I've had a few different perches over the years, if you will. So it's lessons taken from across all those different experiences. So, when it comes to particularly investing, the earlier you go, the more you have to look at your portfolio construction and how you think about shots on goals and what a particular investment does in the context of a broader portfolio. So when I said we made 44 investments, that was a feature, not a bug. Because one thing we learned when you're looking at seed stage investing, whether it was what we were doing at Techstars or also some of my counterparts at places like Y Combinator or AngelList or 500 Startups, everyone was following a very similar playbook. Yeah, but there's a lot of complexity to it. We, in fact, built a data warehouse across 5,000 financings, which taught us a bunch of lessons about how you do seed stage investing. But bottom line, I would say, is it's a different asset class than venture. You got to treat it differently. You got to have many more shots on goal, and you have to be very vigilant about the basis, the cost at which you get in. So there's a handful of lessons like that, and other signals that you look for that we try to apply here.
So I would love to unpack your time as an operator and uh-huh. that influences you today as an investor. Before we do, so are there any? So I heard you loud and clear, 44 investments. I presume there's, key characteristics of the portfolio company profiles that you hone in on. Any in particular that you think are worth mentioning as you're conducting your due diligence?
Well, I'd say there's no magic to what we look for. We're looking for a solid team in a growing market, which has the potential for venture scale with a product that's differentiated and has a moat around it, if you will. So that per se is not different. I'd say some of the things that we try to do is, first of all, we have a pretty broad range of input sources that we use to sort of figure out a company. So we have what we call our brain trust. We have a network of about 35 experts in various areas that we invest in. So part of it is knowing who to call for what kind of problem and who's an expert in a particular area. We also do a bunch of customer calls. We talk to the folks who run the accelerators and other programs that they usually come out of. And the trick is to figure out what questions to ask who. So, for instance, someone who's been in in an accelerator program, the managers there are probably a good source of, hey, how does the team work together? Do they gel? Do they what kind of dynamics are there? How productive are they? How much have they grown over the time that you've known? All of those are useful signals. Now, you don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time on those questions when you're talking to a customer or to your expert. So there's certain sort of customer value proposition questions versus an expert, hey, technical feasibility and how real is this and how much sort of a moat there is, et cetera. So part of it is that in terms of figuring out who to ask what. And then the other thing we've also been doing is we call it cognitive bias reduction, where recognizing that there's a lot of natural biases that everyone brings to the decision-making process. And I mean, I'm sure you've seen through a bunch of work in behavioral psychology and behavioral economics, et cetera. So that part is not new. What we are hoping to do and have been doing is diligently working those into our investment process so that we have a bunch of things we do to say, hey, we're pretty smart guys, and so, but that's, no one's got a a monopoly on that. So we got to be also appropriately humble and say everyone's a potential for cognitive biases. So how do you set up processes internally so that you're not falling prey to that? Right. So in other words, we go in assuming we're human and then figuring out how to correct for this in various ways we sort of set up our processes.
That's fascinating. And from conceptually, I totally agree with the concept. I mean, a close parallel that may resonate with our audience is you think about a trading system. It gives signals, and presuming you've done your homework ahead of time and tested the model, you should follow the signals. But humans,
Tend not to do that.
we may overthink this. And so that'd be, without revealing any proprietary insights, I would love to know is like, what's your experience been? I mean, have you found that you've had to walk away from investments you've otherwise feel really bullish about because the signals are counterintuitive?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'd say, first of all, so we have an interesting team to begin with, because myself and my partner Stuart Davidson, we both have been experienced founders, CEOs, investors, etc. So we've got some of the gray hair, if you will, right? And we also have two folks who are relatively younger in their careers, but exceptionally sharp, a huge amount of growth potential and everything else. And so part of it starts with saying, we're all trying to do the same thing. Let's all be part of the same team. And if anyone gets to stop, that we have this concept called anyone can pull the and-on card. This is a system that was developed in Toyota back in the Kanban days to say anyone on the shop floor, if they see something, say something and pull the card that'll stop the shop floor. And we do that internally. So it doesn't matter what your title is, everyone gets to sort of say. So that's a good way to protect people and say, hey, I something doesn't smell right. Let's talk about this. The other thing is we have very specific stage gates at the various stages of the process, and we have particular things we say, hey, does this check these boxes? If not, let's keep it here before we move it forward to the next stage. We have someone who's designated as a devil's advocate internally for every deal, saying there's obviously someone who's pushing it because they're passionate about it, but someone else gets to say, how could this fail? And it helps the person who is sort of championing a deal to pause and say, oh yeah, let me think about that. And if there's something there, many a time we just walk away from something because something that the devil's advocate said convinced the deal lead. We also look for a pretty semi-programmatic way to do follow-on investments on subsequent ones, where that goes through a very rigorous and semi-programmatic way to make that decision too, so that we guard against the natural VC challenge of falling in love with your own babies. So I could go on. There's a number of things we've thoughtfully tried to say, hey, let's make the best decisions we can. Let's make sure we are using the real minds around the table and benefiting from a diversity of input. but then also recognizing that humans are humans and we'll all make mistakes, so how do we set up processes to correct for it?
I think it's brilliant. I think I saw an article once and they identified over 80 cognitive biases. And so, yeah, I mean, awareness is obviously first step, but then implementing systems and plans to deal with them is another. So kudos. I'd love to come back to investment process, but before we do it, I think it'd be valuable if we take a step back. And if you mentioned some of the success you had as a founder operator, but can you give us a sense of your career progression, leading Vesta, please?
I mean, I'd say in a word, it's been eclectic, and I don't, it's almost calling it a career is being kind in the sense that it's been more. Which itch did I choose to scratch at various stages as I've grown? It's been a series of questions that have bugged me, and it's like, hey, let's go figure that out, kind of thing. So, still using the career metaphor, I'd say there's probably three broad chapters to my story. One, what I call the profit without purpose state. So, that was the more classic sort of corporate world. I came out of business school. I started my career at McKinsey as a consultant there, and then left and joined a group of about 10, 15 folks who ended up becoming the founding team of Media One, which was a pretty large startup because there were about 15 of us. We were given $10 billion to invest in a series of investments and acquisitions in the cable business, and that eventually got sold to AT&T and then to Comcast for $62 billion. So it was a nice startup, but an extremely well-funded one. So got a chance to see the corporate world there, and then that's sort of when I got the bug saying, "Hey, I kind of like what the other guys are doing on the other side of the table, the entrepreneurs," and ended up becoming an entrepreneur. Started, grew, and sold a couple of venture-backed companies. One was called KB Kids, which we later changed the name to eToys because we bought their assets, etc. So it was one of the early e-commerce successes. We grew to about 100 million in sales, which back in the day was real money. And then another one was an enterprise software company called StorePerform, which was then sold off, and it's now part of JDA or Blue Yonder, as it's called now. And that also we grew from 0 to about 25 million in about 4+ years. So I had a chance to see a couple of rapid growth of opportunities. So all of that was sort of the profit without purpose, if you will. And then after selling the second company, was trying to sort of say, hey, what else is out there? Where can we figure out how to use this experience for good? And that's what led me to then move to Seattle, join the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and spend a number of years with them in philanthropic investing. In a nutshell, it was to help use technology to improve the lives of farmers in Africa and Asia. And I myself grew up in India, and both my sets of grandparents were smallholder farmers. So in many ways, that was quite meaningful to me personally, because it was essentially helping millions of folks who were like my grandparents on both sides. And so that was a lot of fun, but it was hard to do while living in Seattle with three kids and spending a lot of time in Africa and Asia. So I ended up then deciding to leave and start a nonprofit college, which is now Mount Saint Mary's University Online, which was again a nonprofit college, but it was using some of the techniques around online education and social and emotional support to try to help the lives of low-income first-generation college kids. And had a blast setting that college up from scratch and getting it accredited, getting it all connected to a whole bunch of other institutions, etc. And while all of that was fun, the most recent itch I've been trying to scratch is to figure out how to take those through lessons from those two chapters of profit without purpose and purpose without profit, which was the and do what we call profit with purpose now. So figuring out how to harness the world of technology and the power of capitalism towards positive impact on the people and the planet. And that's why we chose to focus our efforts on climate change and economic opportunity. And that's sort of what led me to Techstars first. I was a partner on their investment team and their impact guy, and then more recently hung out our own shingle. And the Avesta Fund is the result of all these various pit stops along the way.
Wow. Well, extremely impressive. And congratulations on the success as a founder operator
Thank
as well.
you.
It's not often. Oh, well, not as often as I'd love to say, but that we've had operators who've had successful exits. Key lessons or takeaways you'd share to the entrepreneurs in the audience from your time with eToys or what became Blue Yonder?
Key lesson. Well, I guess the so many lessons. It's so hard to say. I mean, I'd say, I mean, the team. I mean, it really matters who you bring onto the bus and what roles they play and how everyone's rowing in the same direction. I think that's important because it otherwise, if you don't watch out, then it starts to become sort of internal infighting, if you will. But you as the leader has to be focused on who do we bring on and how do you ensure they're all working towards the same goal. I'd say I had, especially in my early days, a tendency to sort of be willing to pivot and be able to sort of change with what the market was saying. But I think as I grew older, I realized that, I use a sailing metaphor. When you sail, you usually have a bearing that you point towards, but the way you get there is by tacking back and forth quite a bit. And while you as the helmsman might always have your eye on the bearing, the folks who are right there on the nearer the water don't see quite that. They see a lot more changes in direction. So it's important to always sort of make sure everyone understands where the bearing is, if you will. And I think that's another thing which is helpful to know because you assume that everyone sees it, but people in their regular jobs probably see more change than you might, and it's on you as the leader to make sure they understand the method behind the madness and make sure that you're not overly pivoting. The trick is to pivot, but not do too much of it.
Yeah, it's great. As I'm listening, one of the practical things that I found is a lot of value in doing monthly all hands, where the team has the opportunity not only to listen from leadership but also ask questions.
Yeah, I'd say in a startup world, at least before, say, Series B, you probably want to do weekly all hands because things change a lot in a month.
And giving just that transparency, I think on a lot of levels is extremely valuable. Totally agree. Philanthropic.
Philanthropic, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm curious, did your lens change at all, knowing that the scope was a little bit different?
Yeah. I think what was cool was I realized that it's actually a lot harder to do philanthropic investing than regular investing. I thought, hey, how hard can it be to give money away? But it turns out that if we actually care about the difference the money is making, yes, you're not measuring it based on IRR or NPV, but to actually figure out whether your money is making a real difference is more difficult than it seems. So that's just sort of going in with that, the humility that implies. To say you don't have the answers, let's go figure out how to ask the right questions. But then, with that is the sense of still combining the head and the heart. I mean, the heart says you want to do this to help improve lives, but then you also want to make sure that the money is being well spent and you're being rigorous about it. I think so. It's bringing a similar level of rigor, but just applying it towards a different goal. So it's not about IRR, it's about philanthropic return on investment, shall we say.
So, I'm curious. It totally makes sense, and I would think too. There's also just the understanding of what are the consequences of deploying this capital. Not a one for one parallel, but an example I've heard in the past for given some philanthropic work my daughter has done in Haiti. But if you come in with, say, just shoes. That are brought aboard, you have to consider, well, are there any shoe businesses in the location you're working, and are you going to put them out of business? I presume that's in scope as you're opportunities.
Very much. I'd say, I mean, in general, you want to lead, you want to let the folks on the ground lead, as in tell you where they want to go, and then figure out if what they want to go, where they want to go fits And you can fill in the blanks. I mean, if it's a health innovation, you can run it by some experts to say, does this actually pass muster? Is this a real innovation? Is this something that works? And you can do that kind of sort of technical analysis to figure out, but you want to understand market-driven needs that you go in to figure out how to fill rather than go in with a solution. Absolutely. Because in this case, yes, you can think the shoes are the solution, but if you don't have the rest of the supply chain figured out, you're just giving them something that won't live much beyond the time when you stop funding it, because they need to have a way to build a business around it.
I'm curious. Can you see a day when Avesta has run its course that you would ever come back to philanthropic investing?
I think I've gotten to the point, having made all these sort of journeys along the way, like I feel very comfortable saying this is my life's work from here on. So I want to make sure I can take the lessons I've learned in the other chapters and bring it to Avesta. But having said that, very much open to helping in other ways that are consistent. For instance, I mean, recently I joined the board of what's called Impact Capital Managers. It's a board of, it's a, I guess, the leading association of impact fund managers. So other funds like ours, which also care about the double bottom line. And there's 150 plus funds in that, and who manage over 50 billion in the aggregate. And so, is there a way to sort of join that group and help steer it towards a direction? There's other things that I do on the side, which are more philanthropic, where it's taking those lessons and applying it in other spheres. But ultimately, in terms of pure my day job, I expect this will be my last one.
All right. Well,
Yeah.
I mean, you and I both know that there's tremendous value in providing liquidity to the early stage market. So that in itself is brilliant, because it's a starting point for a lot of companies that go on to do great stuff.
Yep.
But exciting and fantastic journey. So brings us back to Avesta. So I heard, love to unpack climate tech a bit. For the members of our audience who are not as familiar with the space, are there specific, or what are the flavors of climate tech? And are there any in particular that you're currently drawn to?
Oh boy. Well, there's good and bad news here. The good news is everything around you has a climate impact. But the bad news is everything around you has a climate impact. So you kind of have to know where there is the meeting of a real sort of potential to move the needle on climate, but also a real business model. Because that's part of what we are always spending our time on, saying let's not waste time on stuff that is just ancillary to their business. Their product needs to be something which can make a dent in the problem, because it's a big problem. We're all facing it. But at the same time, it needs to be something that is a venture fundable business. So those two might seem like the obvious ones, but when you start putting things through that filter in a rigorous way, it turns out a lot of very good ideas fall by the wayside for one or more of those reasons. But having said that, I'd say some of the areas we look at are, the whole grid modernization. The electric utilities are going through huge amounts of change, and especially with the waves of AI and crypto and so on, the needs that the grid has to be put through have fundamentally changed over the last 5 years, and will continue to change over the next 20. So, how does that? How are we set up to sort of be ready for that world? How do data centers, which are becoming bigger and bigger, more and more of energy and water and heat hogs, if you will, and how do they deliver what we all need in terms of compute power, but in the cleanest way possible, in the lowest cost way possible? Those are non-trivial challenges, if you will, but it also affects things like how do we move? So what kind of vehicles, everything from micro-mobility to cars and buses and trucks to large shipping and airplanes, everything has a climate impact. How do you figure out how to lower the climate carbon footprint there? The built environment has a number of things. Some of the biggest sources of carbon are the built environment. So I could go on. I mean, I think there's a bunch of areas around climate that we are interested in, but we always put them through that lens of real climate impact and real potential for financial rewards.
That makes good sense. It also helps understand why you have a network of experts who are going to support
Yes.
decision. Yeah.
Exactly.
There's so many domains that this touches. And so with that, what are you most bullish on right now?
You mean in terms of a sector or in terms of
What has your attention? What do you find yourself gravitating towards? Again, without revealing any trade secrets, what are you most excited about?
I'd say, I mean, and again, I should clarify, as an early stage investor, it's important to look for capital light investments, because there are some very capital intensive and long time to fruition kinds of products. A new form of cement will take, for instance, several hundred million before they, hit any kind of scale. That's not necessarily a great place for an early stage investor like us, if you will, especially with a more regular venture horizon, 10-year horizon. So we try to look for commercialization ready and light asset kind of models, if you will. So with that caveat, I'd say, there's a variety of places where data and AI and software meets the needs of some of those areas we talked about, whether it is the grid or data center operations or the built environment, et cetera. There are ways to use either pure software and AI and based models, or light hardware that has then been that enables you to create a new form of data and then figure out how to put some software around it. So those are some of the things we look at in some of those areas that I mentioned.
Got it. It's interesting. Do you find though that because you're focused on climate that you'll do a lot of co-investing with corporate VCs, or do you find that no, it really just runs the gamut. There's a good mix of financial and corporate both.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because when we started the fund 4 years ago, we went to a regular, the more typical kinds of LPs. So we have, the more typical fa family offices, some foundations, and so on, and very high net worth individuals in our LP base. But then about a couple of years into it, we realized that especially in climate, you really do need to lean into the corporate connection quite a bit. And that then led us about a year and a half ago to start to build out a network of corporate partners. And so we actually have over 60 of the largest corporations around the world who are members of what we call Avesta Nexus. And we don't even, if you went to our website, you would see nothing of that. We try to do this and keep it quiet. And it's more, this is part of our expert network, if you will, because so they're not just experts as individual, but we also have corporations in the network that we share deals with and get their input on. And it's a win-win-win, because we get the startup in on the corporate's radar, we get input that helps inform our diligence, and the corporates start to know what's coming down the pike. And so that's been a very successful process for us over the last year. Like I said, I mean, it grew from an idea in our heads to a fairly vibrant and diverse network of corporations that are being introduced to these startups. So that's the extent of what we have been doing so far, because, like I said, I mean, this is for a fund that's already been set up, and we are still in the process of deploying that fund. So we didn't go to these corporates and go to them for an LP relationship. We're just running the fund that we've raised. But I think looking ahead, we have decided that this is an area that we need to lean in more into, in terms of continuing to think and be focused around how we can help corporations and startups be better at collaborating with each other to help reduce emissions. That's easier said than it's done, because while both sides of that equation, the startups and the corporation, want to work with each other, and there are some real benefits they get from each other, they're not particularly good at doing it. And there are some real challenges. I myself mentioned my own background. I started out in McKinsey consulting to corporates, and then went to a corporate myself, and then spent the bulk of my career in the startup world. I know that they have value to offer each other. They're not the best at figuring out how to talk to each other. And that's something that we are leaning more and more into, to figure out how we can help in that process.
I mean, I think it makes great sense. And you know, but I would be curious. I don't know how much thought you've given to the dichotomy between investment time horizon. You know, for you know, arguably most financial VC LPs are looking to 7 to 8 years of return or time horizon on a fund, where you know, a corporation can have a much playing a much longer game.
Yep.
How do you think about reconciling the two?
Well, I mean, this is a real issue. It's not, I don't want to paper over what you're, because there's a lot of questions under the question you just asked. And I don't think there's one answer that fits all the situation. So in other words, there are some things you just have to call a spade and say, this is going to take 15 years to get to fruition. And therefore it's probably not the best thing for a 10-year fund to do. Or there are some examples of things where you say this may be something that needs philanthropic or philanthropically aligned capital to keep it going, or grant capital, in other words, for the next 5 years before it's got that inflection point towards commercialization. So you find ways to hand off to other players in the capital stack who can handle it better. Similarly, there are corporations who may have a longer time horizon, but often more likely even a short time horizon, because corporations are also subject to the pressures of the quarterly earnings call and so on. So you've got to figure out which kind of money is right for which kind of idea, and try to stay in your lane, because it's easy to get caught up in the fact that something has the potential to make a real difference, but if it's not going to let you deliver a good return to your investors, then you're not doing your job.
I mean that you can see how it could be challenging. But I'm curious. Something you said triggered a thought. How often will you exit positions within the fund, maybe earlier than you'd like, just because you think that the time horizon really is going to extend further based on what you know now?
It's probably too early to say too much about our plans at this point, because we only set up the fund 4 years ago, and I'd say just for the average age of our investment is just about 2 years. But having said that, we've already started exiting some investments and giving money back to our investors. So we've had a couple of those already. So we intend to continue doing that. So I think there's no one answer to it, but I think the short answer is remain open to what the market is telling you. So I think the risks there are holding on too long and are not holding on long enough. So part of it is to figure out if there's a reasonable offer that comes to the table, take it seriously and see if that's a reasonable one to take. And in these couple of key instances that I mentioned, that was the right answer for the company and for the founders and the investors. And then there are other times when you say, hey, this thing is growing. In fact, we have a couple of those examples where things are growing up and to the right in terms of revenues and valuations, et cetera. And in those kinds of instances, I think we'd remain open to doing at least a part of it in a secondary transaction, because I think there's always value in giving money back to your investors. But at the same time, in those kinds of instances, you probably want to keep some powder dry for the eventual huge exit. So it's a matter of sort of paring off a portion of your position, but so that you've provided some return, but at the same time have some upside that remains.
Do you think the mindset of potentially exiting early is a typical mindset amongst venture capital investors? And if it isn't, why do you think that is?
Well, it's back to the idea of falling in love with your babies. I think that is a real cognitive bias, if you will. And I think some of those kinds of things are the kinds of processes we've instituted internally to say, at what point do you say, hey, we need to take some money off the table? And we still leave room for upside, but you can't let greed control all of it, if you will. And so that's a natural thing where I think a lot of venture investors think a lot about when they get in, but they don't think as much about when they get out. And you need to be as rigorous about that decision as you do on the former.
You know, it's interesting as I'm listening again, I'm thinking back to trading systems, and there's similar criticisms where everyone has spent a lot of time on your entry points, but not as much time on your exit points.
Yep. Yep.
And just hearing you logically conclude that, not having, I haven't heard you say that you're trading stocks, but to hear you logically conclude that is encouraging, because I agree, it just makes good sense. Having
Now, again, I mean, you can take that analogy too far because, I mean, stocks, you get instant feedback, and those traders, I mean, you're getting daily sort of making. We're clearly in it for the long haul in terms of being there side by side with the founders and helping and supporting them. But at the end of the day, we just have to be aware that this is a business, and we need to provide returns to our shareholders. So, to the extent that that's true, you have to figure out what's the right way and right time to exit.
Srikant, tons of great insights. Appreciate your time. Before we wrap up, a little bit of a retrospective. If you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self, what insights or wisdom would you share?
That's a good one. I'd say one comes to mind is look for the win-win. And maybe I should caveat it by saying, I grew up in India. I went to school there. I even started my career there for a year. And the India I grew up with had a lot less opportunity than the one you read about in the papers today. And so there was a sense of a scarcity mindset, shall we see. So on the good news of that was it sort of honed a competitive instinct. But the flip side to that was that scarcity mindset, which where you kind of focused on how you needed to make sure you came out on top. And I'd say the younger self, if I had to go back, I'd say look for the win-win. Maybe it's a question of having sort of been fortunate in some of these things, but I think looking back, I would still want to bring that abundance mindset to say someone else doesn't have to lose for you to win, and we can all win.
It's interesting. Do you think the zero-sum game mindset was unique to India, or do you think it has more to do with youth in age?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure youth and age has something to do with it, and also having a sense of, hey, at least a base level of comfort that you can get to, if you will. But I think it also has to do with the environment you're in. I'd say when you can't be assured of the basics, right, you tend to bring more of a scarcity mindset. And I mean, even, for instance, I mean, I grew up in certainly a milieu of that scarcity mindset, the India I grew up in. But in many ways, paradoxically, the America that I came to over 30 years ago had a very abundance mindset orientation back then, but it's also showing signs of that scarcity mindset today. And I think that's partly because people are less sure about their futures. And when you're less sure, you want to make sure you're protecting your downside, if you will. And that's sort of where it comes from. But I prefer to think of how we can all get to the upside together.
Well, I mean, I think that's a brilliant insight. I had never thought about it like that. As I listen to you, I have seen instances of what you're describing around me. I think it, and then as I just think about answering the question why, it seems like it would be a natural derivative of the business cycle. As you see a correction, especially you can no longer claim ignorance is bliss because you just came from a great spot and you want to get back there. You start asking questions of what do I need to do to make sure I stay there? And I bet you we could probably devote a podcast of the consequences
No, indeed.
about that. But no, I agree. I mean, if I had to say what was a good antidote, faith in just believing that everything was going to work out for the best. In my personal experience is very valuable, but yes, I agree. Creating win-win scenarios or I can't imagine going a different route.
Indeed. It took me a bit longer to learn that lesson, but here we are.
Here we are. Well, me too. Apologies if I left the impression I knew it from the get-go. I didn't. Anyone in your career who's had a material impact on you that you'd like to give a shout out to and recognize for just being an amazing all-around person.
I'd say, I mean, on a personal level, my parents and my wife have been there. My parents for giving me all the opportunities. I mean, and I, they didn't, I mean, I didn't grow up with a lot of material. I mean, we were not well off by any stretch of the means, but they also always instilled a sense of you can do it if you set your mind to it. And I think that mindset, I have to thank them for. And my wife's been through, I mean, I mentioned all the twists and turns my career has taken. I cannot imagine what it would have been like if she hadn't been supportive through that process. So that's been great. I'd say, I mean, I don't know that, I mean, I can think of a couple of people, not so much that they need my shout outs, and it'll become obvious why I'm saying that, but they certainly taught me by virtue of being in the room with them. And I'd say, my first job in India was with Tata Industries, which is a very large conglomerate. And for whatever reason, Mr. Ratan Tata, who ran the entire conglomerate, sort of took an interest in me, and I would have monthly meetings with him. And I got to sort of know how he operated just because he took an interest and wanted to see what I was up to. And then more recently, when I was at Gates Foundation, I had a chance to interact with Bill Gates several times through various things. And I could not think of two people who are more different in their demeanor and their personalities. Ratan Tata was humble, soft-spoken, really sort of self-effacing, and none of which are the words that come to mind when you think of Bill Gates. He's intense, he's focused, he's a driver. But having said that, both were very much driven by the content of what was being discussed, and they were quite happy to set aside their egos and their sort of what they came in with a pretty good sense of self, but they were very much driven by curiosity and learning, and I think that's kind of stuff I try to bring. But they're certainly role models that, like I said, I mean, they don't need my shout outs, but they deserve my gratitude, if you will, for having
Well,
me.
I'm sure if they were here in the room, they'd still appreciate the recognition because they left the positive impression on you. So
Yep, they sure did.
great stuff. Srikant, I appreciate your time. Thank you. Tremendous amount of insights in here. I know I learned a lot. If there are any members of our audience who'd like to get a hold of you or want to learn more about the Avesta Fund, how can they find you?
Yeah, I mean, easy to find. Avesta.fund, basically. It gives a lot of info. I mean, what we've been talking about, and then some, and how to get in touch with us and everything else. So look forward to hearing from you. If you have a product, a company, if you're interested in the fund, learning more about it, happy to answer any questions there.
Fantastic. And with that, again, for the benefit of our audience, Srikant Vasan, Srikant, founder and managing partner of Avesta Fund. Srikant, thank you again and appreciate your time.
Thank you, Christian. The pleasure to be here. Enjoyed the discussion. Take care.
Pleasure is all ours. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder CEO of Finstrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.